I'm a human, and as an individual, what can I do in my daily life to view a disability in a new light or to help with the advocacy component, and how are my behaviors possibly harmful to that community?
A lot of universities and high-income institutions, they go to places, they send researchers, the researchers get a nice research paper out of it, but they do not create long-term engagements or relationships with these places, very vulnerable places and communities they're engaging with.
I really think, too, that for any global issue, community and unity is always going to be the answer.
If all else fails and we are not successful in stopping what's coming, I don't want to say that I spent the last time before that period comes filled with dread and not hoping that our community can do the best things possible.
Welcome to Season 5 of Campus Conversations, the podcast. I'm Joni Mahoney, and I have the honor of serving as SUNY ESF president. ESF is a small college with big ideas, and this season, I'm speaking with faculty, students, and staff who make ESF mighty, the people working to improve our world and sustain the environment. I am excited to welcome two ESF students today, Isabel Valentin and Savannah Wright. Isabel is a senior pursuing her degree in environmental studies with a concentration in environmental policy planning and law. Savannah just graduated with a bachelor's degree in landscape architecture from ESF in May and is now a master's student in the program. Both are passionate about the sociocultural aspects of climate change, particularly the influence of culture on society and how it affects both human behavior and climate change. Thank you for joining me today. I was really excited to do this because this is the first time I've just had students. There have been a couple times that I've interviewed faculty with labs that have had students that came in and joined them, but to just have a conversation with students is wonderful. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So I was interested when I was reading about you both, and you both brought experiences into your studies. And I think that's really interesting. And I wonder if it's a model really for people to thrive, to say what matters so much to you. And I imagine, and I want to hear from you, that it provides drive for you to find solutions when it's something that is so close to home. So Isabel, we're going to start with you. And the experience that I'm referring to is that you grew up on Puerto Rico. So you and your family have really experienced firsthand the effects of climate change. And I'm interested in how those experiences led you to be a student here at ESF.
Yeah. So my first experience with climate change, I was probably 9 or 10 years old, and it was when the holes in the ozone layer really started becoming like nationwide news, and we were talking about it in my science courses. And I don't remember who asked the question. The teacher might have brought it up unprompted, but she said that because Puerto Rico is a small island, for those who don't know, Puerto Rico is 100 miles wide and 35 miles long, Puerto Rico suffers a bigger risk that when the hole in the ozone layers causes higher heat, the ice everywhere melts, and that turns into the elevation of water, which could consume Puerto Rico, which is a very real thing to say. It is completely rooted in reality, but of course, for a young student, and maybe a little distressing,
terrifying.
Which is where my brain went immediately after that. I tend to be very proactive about things that scare me or things that I'm passionate about. So immediately after learning about that, I had like a couple weeks of panic, and then I just started doing things that felt helpful. And all of that in Puerto Rico, in the context of Puerto Rico, is very different than in the context of the United States. There's a lot of active struggles. In 2017, Hurricane Maria hit. I had just founded an environmental organization. There was a lot of loss of steam from that project because of Hurricane Maria. COVID hit. There have also been earthquakes, more natural disasters. And all of these experiences kind of made my research focused on the now and how the past affects the now. And the combination of those two factors is what leads me to think of a future. I don't think thinking of a better future from the standpoint of the present is very helpful, because the present is often putting out fires. The present is all often hectic and over-involved. You have to combine aspects of the past, present, to think of the future. And I think that's how my experience in Puerto Rico kind of molded my mindset as to how I'm going to tackle climate change or sociocultural issues or all those other big, big questions that we're trying to answer here at ESF.
I appreciate that. And Savannah, for you, it was something that happened kind of along the way in your educational experience that's really honed you in on an area of study. But tell us a little bit about yourself. You grew up in Central New York or the Finger Lakes?
I'm from Rochester originally. I originally was pursuing a degree in architecture, and I was in Toronto for that. And then I ended up coming back to the States because it didn't have enough of the natural world involved in it. And I found, especially being in a university setting downtown, it was just heavily focused on the built world and sort of modernizing everything. And so I thought that going into landscape architecture, where people naturally gravitate towards some different realm of it, there's usually a lot of subcategories. I thought that I was going to choose sort of this like urban revitalization and green infrastructure. And then during sophomore year, I had personal experiences, and COVID sort of exacerbated them, but also observing other built spaces where people with disabilities can't necessarily experience or enjoy it the same way. And one of these experiences rattled me. It wasn't on campus, but it was in Syracuse. And so I started to shift my focus from this topic that sort of 90% of people are studying right now, which is this urban, you know, how do we protect urban communities and bring green infrastructure? And I shifted my focus to accessibility. And I started diving deeper into, you know, like what currently exists for access, especially in design fields. Back in the 1980s, there was the ADA laws, and that was sort of like the first sparked movement of access for people. But as time evolves, that legislation also needs to evolve, and it really hasn't.
So you're referring to the Americans with Disabilities Act for those of us outside that world.
Mm-hmm. And pertaining specifically to the design fields, like there are certain protocol and standards that have been created through that legislation that say, you know, in our new builds, we have to have 36-inch doors, or we have to have sinks that are X amount of inches high. And that is addressing a larger percent of people that have physical disabilities. But now, as we see with mental health decline and the introduction of more conditions or chronic disease, those are all things that affect how people live their daily lives. And those need to be accounted for when we design spaces, whether they're public or private homes. And then also the protocol that surrounds that, and really like, how are we viewing disability and how are we creating this universal design that is optimal for people of all walks of life and all sorts of access.
So you're referring then to disabilities that might not be obvious to people walking past you on the street.
Yep.
They're disabilities, no less, or challenges for folks. And how can you design landscapes that can be healing or calming? What is the word that I want to say?
It's, I want to say moldable, because we want to build spaces that can accommodate the most amount of people with one design. So typically what I mean when I speak about a lens of disability and these public environments is, if you see a ramp, a lot of times people will assume that, oh, it's for someone who uses a wheelchair. However, if you design a ramp the right way, it's also accommodating strollers. It's accommodating bikes and canes, or people that are carrying really heavy stuff that can't go upstairs. So it's for everybody. It's not just pertaining to the disabled community. So when we can start to shift our spaces and the way that we design things, we start to accommodate everyone unintentionally with one design.
That's excellent. And that was a really good example. So then, just taking a little bit of a step back, you two are from a generation, and Isabel, you just said you were 9 years old when you were told that Puerto Rico is going to be underwater. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what the anxiety is around climate for people your age. And I wonder if this work makes that better, or if this work exacerbates that anxiety, because now you know that there really are big challenges that the planet has right now.
Yeah, I think Isabel and I need each other. And I say that like our topics need each other, because what Isabel deals with is sort of this eco-anxiety. And if you look at sort of what right now is taking over a large percent of the population, especially people our age, it's anxiety, depression, and all of these conditions that are invisible disabilities. Like it makes your life harder to live. It interferes with your daily life. But I also need that work on climate change to be able to continue my work. And I'm also trying to address some of that fear and that daily life that comes along with living in a climate change
era, you know? I totally get what you're referring to. It's pretty amusing because we're engaging in all this long-term infrastructural planning, social planning, and we don't really know if anyone's going to be alive to see it. It's really terrifying when you think about it. But in my personal experience, I spent most of my childhood and early teens just overwhelmed with anxiety about whether or not, you know, the world is ending, all that good stuff. And when I finally started organizing in a serious way and I started doing tangible work, I wouldn't say I got over the anxiety. Sometimes you have a bad day, but most days I'm filled with hope because I find that being driven by dread or being driven by fear is a lot less helpful, is
tolerable.
A lot less, yeah. It's a lot less tolerable than any other alternative. So I lead with hope and I try to fight off every other emotion because at least if all else fails and we are not successful in stopping what's coming, I don't want to say that I spent the last time before that period comes filled with dread and not hoping that our community can do the best things possible.
You know, we had a speaker at commencement, Savannah,
yes.
your commencement.
We're actually really close now, too.
Oh, yeah.
We've been in touch, and she's actually working on new stuff, too. So I'm sure you'll see about that, too. But related to this topic.
How did that come about?
I followed her on Instagram after, and we connected, and I got to speak with her. Actually, Isabel, you were there, too. But
yeah,
right before, we kind of met with her and went over what we were working on. And she was like, you know, mental health and disability, like this is all really interesting related to climate change. So she ended up reaching out to me after I followed her and we've sort of been in touch and just like supporting each other from afar. But
I love that. And
yeah.
She wrote the book, The Climate
yeah.
Optimist.
Yeah, fantastic.
And it kind of goes to what Isabel was just talking about. And I also hear from students, and you can let me know if this is the case for you, but coming to a place like ESF where the generations ahead of you have been doing this work, for some students has been really reassuring because the general easy talking point was no one did anything and now your generation is left to clean all of this up. But you come to ESF and you find out there are people that have spent their entire professional careers doing the work that now the whole world is realizing is necessary to solve these problems. And it created for them a sense of hope to be mm-hmm. in a place like this.
Yeah. I really think, too, that for any global issue, community and unity is always going to be the answer. And, you know, it's one thing to say, I have this very valid fear, but then to turn the fear into something and sort of rally the troops, as I like to call it, is you're going to attract more bees with honey than you will with water. And so to like bring that hope to the table and approach it from a different lens, I think is long-term going to get more people on board with the work that we're doing and just be more beneficial for promising outcomes.
Yeah, right where Sav started. I honestly, the reason I am this hopeful is because I believe in the power and the unity of our frontline communities, of marginalized communities, of our elders, all people that predeceased us that did this work and can teach us about it. So I find that being in a place where people have always been doing this work and are willing to teach it to you in such an accessible way, it really has changed the way I want to teach and the way I want to educate other people about what's happening.
So here at ESF, you're surrounded by people that are passionate about this topic and working on these things. But outside of here, you know, growing up, I guess, Isabel, it's different for you in Puerto Rico than it is for you in Rochester, where the effects are a little bit more distant. But is it true that this is front of mind for young people, no matter where they are? Have young people really tuned into issues about the environment and climate change?
I think it's hard because the direct divide that I've seen sort of correlates to political beliefs. And so I feel like that very like polarized view of things is making it really challenging to sway people or get them on board with whatever sort of action we're trying to take. But I do think, especially in people my age, many of us, if not the majority of us, are leaning towards, you know, okay, we're facing a problem and now we have to do something about it. And for the most part, people, especially at ESF, are some of the most eager to learn people that I've ever met. And our students are never afraid to like stand up and say something.
I love it too.
It's like the passion that we bring is what inspires other people to come here. And so, you know, I think this is a really good place to start with any sort of action, because you very easily get a community of like, what is it, 2,800 people that we have here? Something along those lines. You know, you get a pretty large community of people that have your back. And so, yeah.
Growing up in Puerto Rico is definitely a very different experience. There are very tangible effects. And even the most conservative of people, the people that whose political belief and party politics do not engage at all with the general perspective of people that, you know, agree with climate change or disagree with climate change, I'd say that most people in Puerto Rico have some sort of awareness what's going on. There have been so many hurricanes in the past couple of years. The rapid escalation of natural disasters, their intensity, their length, how often they're happening. No one can deny that it's real. And if you're living it, there's nothing else to say. But I would say that the youth has mobilized substantially in Puerto Rico, but nowhere near enough. And it's not really because people don't believe in it, because they don't believe that they can do change. I just find that, especially, I don't know if this is your experience, Savannah, but in Puerto Rico, there's just this feeling of perceived hopelessness that it's the game is over, the war has been lost, and there's nothing we can do about it. And that's obviously not the case. There are things that people in every step of life can do about it.
I find that easily believed because you're a small island in the ocean. And for young people growing up and just experiencing disaster after disaster, threat after threat, right? Because you hear about the hurricanes coming, some hit, some don't, right? But you're constantly in this fear. I get how that leads to the hopelessness there. That would be very different than Savannah and I have growing up in Central New York, which is a place that is less likely to feel those effects. I hope it's not going to take everybody experiencing what Puerto Ricans have experienced for the bells to be rung and for people to all coalesce around leadership that's going to get us out of this.
I would say the bells have been rung long ago. And the problem is that there's not an alarm going off. Kind of how it sounds like in my head is just the constant fire drill alarm from high school. And it's just like, it's always there. It's happening. It's nothing I can do about it. But I've learned to balance it out with the other sounds, because I find that students need to feel like they're helpful. Everyone needs to feel like they're helpful. Everyone needs to feel like their work is making an impact, which is why it's so important in local organizing, international organizing, community organizing, for people to find out what their goals are when it comes to organizing, what they want to help in, and then apply them in relation to their own experience, interests. That's why it's so interesting that, for example, Savannah's interests are disability politics. My interests lie within racial politics and injustices. I'm sure so many other people in ESF can say that they're interested in different topics. So we all need to put our hands to these different topics and get to work. And all of this collective action is what will actually lead to the ringing of the bells, bringing solutions.
I couldn't agree more. It is a little discouraging. Savannah, you referred to the politics and the divide, and it's unbelievable how quickly the world, the United States anyhow, has changed in terms of these bright lines. You know, there was a time when I used to say 10% of the population was over there and 10 was way over there, and the 80% in the middle, you know, kind of call them as they see them and can overlap and see a lot of common ground. But it just feels like in the very recent past, we've become incredibly polarized.
And very little room to change your mind about anything. It's like if you fall on one side, then you are strictly adhering to all of those beliefs. Where, you know, every time I've been posed questions or new thoughts, it's like I will take those thoughts, I will think about them, and I'll weigh it out. You know, if I'm presented with enough facts and enough scientific information, yeah, I'll change my mind.
Exactly.
You know, it's okay to change your mind.
That is such a you know, wonderful thing for you to say, and it is so disappointing. You can predict what so many of our elected officials are going to say, because that's the team they're on and that's the team line.
Something that definitely adds to that is the creation of social media and the the levels of engagement that people are reaching with each other right now has become substantially limited by access to social media, by COVID 2020, so many other factors. And I feel like that adds into this echo chamber that everyone's in, where the information that they know and the ideas that they have just keep being repeated back to them from different sources. So people not only have these, excuse me, whack opinions, but they also feel incredibly validated in them.
You know, that is very true. When I was growing up, we had the big networks, mm-hmm. and you had the evening news for half an hour on one of three big networks, and then you had your newspapers. We were all getting the same information. But now we're able to curate that, and you will just hear those validating opinions if that's all you want to hear. I was really surprised and disappointed that I think the youngest person on the debate stage recently for the presidential election called climate change a hoax. And I was like, wow, I really thought that that group of people was headed toward retirement. That's why I love talking to people your age to say, in your social groups outside of ESF, where you grew up, is it debated anymore?
That's not debatable. It's simply spoken about.
And I would
circles.
Imagine that's the case in Puerto Rico. But how about in Rochester?
For the younger generation, and even within Rochester, it's so polarized depending on where you live, right? If you are somewhere rural, like I grew up in a rural town called Leroy. There were like 400 kids in my school, and it was grades 7 through 12. You couldn't find 5% of that population that believed in climate change. And then I moved to Webster, which is like closer to the city. It's much larger. And I found that like as I moved more towards the urban area, things became a little bit more liberal and the beliefs geared more towards supporting action against climate change.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, geographic location has a large impact, at least where I'm from, about people's views. But, you know, I also went to school in Canada as well for a bit, and everyone's on board. You know, it's very much like what Isabel said. It's not debatable. Again, I think there's something in the U.S. There's a bug in the U.S. or something.
I think it's really interesting that you spoke about Rochester rural people tending to be more anti-climate change and urban people being pro-climate change, especially considering how climate change and its effects are affecting specifically the Northeast. Rural communities have not really felt the consequences of that tangibly in the way, for example, Puerto Rico has, where the crops are destroyed and they're arid, it's impossible to grow on them. But people in urban areas are feeling it a little bit more because of the concentration of heat, the way that gentrification has completely affected the infrastructure of buildings, how failing infrastructure doesn't support water drainage, concerns about what's going to flood. Recently, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, New York City completely flooded because of a random rainfall. So that infrastructural deficit is one of the reasons I would say that urban people in areas that are experiencing less climate change effects are more concerned about it, because they do have the tangible something's off.
Yep. I think things are definitely more noticeable in urban areas. But I also wonder, too, and this would probably be a great thesis topic to study, correlative to like public space usage and sort of like human behavior. You know, we look at the activities and the work that people are engaging with in downtown urban areas where a lot of office headquarters are. There's big business down there. And like you look at the attitudes of the people who are living downtown, they're young, they're active, they're engaged with the environment, they don't mind walking or they're commuting. And so I think there's also a sort of like a personality shift that happens between living in an urban area versus living rurally, and what that different environment provides. And obviously they house different activities. So I think that would be like an interesting study to do, is like find out that correlation, like what it is that these people are engaging with downtown and how does that activity lifestyle differ from.
And also informs their opinions, you know, not only like what are they seeing and what are they doing, but how is that informing their opinions?
Yeah. And that kind of ties into environmental education interpretation, because whatever these people are learning about, actually, environmental education interpretation is a new major at ESF, a new program that you can join if you're interested in this. But the way that people are educated can definitely be modified to what we find works. So if, for example, people in urban areas are learning a lot about climate change because of programs, because of specific life experiences, because of different educators' implementation methods or how they choose to phrase it, we can take those as models and apply them otherwise, other places. And it's necessary because if in places like urban Rochester, people are hyper aware of climate change, why can't we take those tools that we've gained from that education and apply in places that don't have the knowledge? A lot of times, lack of knowledge is due to lack of accessibility. I find that shaming people for not being educated about climate change is contradictory to what we're trying.
Yeah, it's counterproductive.
We need everyone on board. And it's the way we need to do that is bolstering our education systems. And the only way we can do that is listening to people that it worked on, listening to the people it hasn't worked on, and combining those perspectives.
So let's take it backwards just a little bit and talk about what the work is that you're doing here. What is your area of study and what are you working on that is reflecting this passion that you have?
You mentioned I'm an environmental studies major focusing in policy and law. My minors are in food studies and Indigenous peoples, the environment. I'm in the honors program as well, which means I am developing a thesis. And that's mostly what my research is based around, though I have a few other projects going on I won't take up all the mic time with. My thesis is about marginalized communities' engagement, specifically with university and academic institutions. So as a Puerto Rican, I had a lot of experience with people researching upon Puerto Rico, starting projects, launching ideas, and then it falling through the cracks, never getting actually proactively done after a couple of years because people become frustrated with the infrastructural challenges, with the lack of movement, with the bureaucracy. It never develops into something tangible that benefits people's quality of life. So it really is a drain. It's an energy drain. It's a time drain. It's a resources drain. And when I came to SUNY ESF, I found that while I was researching for other classes, that a lot of universities and high-income institutions tend to do the same. They go to places, they send researchers, the researchers get a nice research paper out of it, but they do not create long-term engagements or relationships with these places, very vulnerable places and communities they're engaging with. So my thesis is about creating a set of guidelines for the educators that are traveling to these different places to do their research, be it on climate change, be it on any other topic, that they should follow in order to a model to that sense.
Oh, I absolutely love that idea. And you and I just spent time together in Puerto Rico.
It's very applicable.
Yes, we had an opportunity to hear from some students who had gone to school on Vieques,
which
was hit so hard by Maria. Yeah.
Vieques is an island that is external to Puerto Rico, but it's still part of the Puerto Rican archipelago, which actually does not just consist of Puerto Rico, but consists of three different islands, Vieques, Culebra, and Puerto Rico.
Thank you very much for that. The students that we heard from did talk about the fact that people showed up and then they were gone, and then different people showed up and then they were gone. It made me really proud to sit at that table to know that ESF has been showing up in Vieques since Hurricane Maria and has consistently had students and staff that have gotten to know people on the island, and there's a level of trust and there's some real work that's being done. But it didn't sound like that was the generally the case. And I think having a best practices for you to be able to share with other institutions that want to be helpful, but have to recognize the effect of showing up, as you said, writing a paper and then leaving.
And there's unbiased, there's hidden biases, subconscious biases that affect every researcher that they also need to unpack. There's so many factors.
There's also the reception that the next researcher is going to get and what you're doing to the ability for people to continue to show up when locals maybe will get fed up because they put a lot of time and effort and, you know, they invest in these people that come here that say they want to help and they're there for a short time and then they're gone.
So future researchers tend to get hostile reactions from the communities, which are understandable based on the circumstances. The biggest issue with the way information is researched in academic institutions is that a lot of academics believe that you can just be different than the people around you just by thinking different thoughts. If you are not actively fighting and unlearning systems of oppression that were built into us the second we were born, then you are perpetuating them. So what I'm trying to do is teach people that have not had the awareness or access to this information how they can not only unlearn, but actually free their thought process from these colonial racist narratives that were imposed upon us since our youth.
Interesting. Interesting. And how about you, Savannah? What is the work that you're doing here I know you finished your undergraduate here, and I was very happy to hear that you chose ESF for your master's program. And I've seen you out and about, and I've been able to interact with you with some of your designs. But specific to the accessibility and the components of that design that we might not be obvious to us when we walk around, what kinds of work are you doing?
So grad school was not in the picture originally, but once I finished, I like to call it like an undergraduate capstone because my last 2 years or so, I really focused on a project called mental health accessibility, which came up with 6 categories of design solutions and physical elements for built spaces that accommodate psychological conditions and invisible disabilities that are cognitive or psychological. As I studied the ADA laws and what currently existed, you know, I found myself saying, well, this is great. This is accessible for people who have physical disabilities. But for those of us that have cognitive or psychological disabilities, there's a lot lacking in public space that could be there. So I took 31 DSM diagnoses, the DSM is tricky because it promotes the medical model of disability, which I don't support. However, it is to get people on board. It's a piece of literature that's universally recognized between many people. So it's easy to quantify and categorize and things like that. So I used the DSM-5, 31 diagnoses, and basically went through and listed the symptoms of those diagnoses and found the opposite. So what is, you know, if you experience hot flashes, what is the solution to that thing? Well, it's to provide areas of coolness or natural breeze or things like that. And those become design elements that you can incorporate into public spaces in many different categories. And a lot of times these solutions address multiple conditions with one go. So that was undergrad. And over the summer, before I decided to go back to grad school, I was trying to introduce this to like Syracuse Parks and other firms and designers. And it very quickly dawned on me that there are still people who, number one, don't know what an invisible disability is, or they're using the medical model of disability, like in healthcare practices and things like that. And that the people who I'm going to design things for are practicing harmful methods of viewing disability. And so how can I design something that's accessible when the person who's going to be utilizing the space, number one, isn't going to support my design, and number two, doesn't even understand the complexity behind the reason for the design? So in order to implement any sort of progressive thinking in landscape architecture or design, and this is where I've gotten some pushback in the LA department specifically, because a lot of people say, well, what does this have to do with landscape architecture or design? My capstone is actually not directly landscape architecture related. I am breaking down the 2 most prominent institutions, which are education and healthcare, finding all of the ways, the protocol, the physical environments, the unwritten protocol and the norms that are harmful for the disabled community, and then rewriting those in a less harmful model so that at the end of this, I could basically take this capstone project, hand it to the leaders of these institutions and say, okay, here's what you need to do to make this an accessible and inclusive space.
That is hilarious. I did not know that was your research. Yes. We're doing the exact same thing, but about different things. You're giving instructions to people that do not have access to the knowledge,
it's
but
basically
an inspiring topic.
I had no idea coming into this that you were, as Isabel just pointed out, your goal is to teach people.
Yeah, it's a change theory. It's
about unintentional harmful methods of conscious bias. We're really on the same topic. It's different sides of the spectrum.
We talked about that in our debrief before. It's like we're essentially doing the same thing for like particularly minority communities, and it's just it's difficult because people will say that, you know, well, we've already had the ADA laws and that landscape architecture has already been involved in that. And you could build the most inclusive, beautiful, accessible design outside of a building. But if the protocol that's taking place inside of those buildings or those spaces or the way that they view disability is still operating under a harmful model, it's pointless. Nothing's accessible about it because the people who need the access that are visiting these spaces are still engaging socially in conversation. Disability doesn't just exist in physical space. It doesn't just exist in a doorway or on a stair. It exists in conversations and it exists in protocol and stories and experiences. So in order to be able to be progressive as a field of landscape architecture, somebody has to make that sacrifice and say, hey, we can't do what we're supposed to do to make things accessible until you all shift your lens and start changing these protocols.
And, you know, if you rewind the clock 30 years ago or so to when the ADA came into being, there was probably someone similarly situated to where you are and meeting with all of these, you know, all this pushback and barriers and disbelief, but they pursued and they made things better. And now that's 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And when you say all the things we've learned, but also the huge epidemic in mental health issues and going back really to a 9-year-old being told that her home was going to be underwater. I mean, it's kind of hard for those of us who didn't grow up like that to believe, but all of that begs now for the next step. And I just love that it's an ESF student that's pursuing this, even though you're getting some of that pushback. That's what it's going to take to make the change. Yeah. And I hope that it will be codified. I don't know where you would start, if you would start at the municipal level or the state level or the federal government, but the ADA needs to be amended to include psychological and, yeah, you know,
and this book that I made in undergrad is essentially that amendment. Like if I were to give it to the legislators and say, hey, you can put this in writing and amend it to the ADA, like it's already done for you. Why wouldn't you amend it? You know, like somebody else has already done the work for you. And I welcome that pushback. I love the pushback because it reassures me that reassures me that I have done my research. I had to give a presentation the other day about the capstone proposal, and it's like we get questions at the end, and I left there feeling like, wow, I really have done my research. No wonder I don't sleep, because all I do is research this and I study this and I work some more. But like, I feel really good about it. You know, I feel like I welcome that challenge, and I don't really care what challenge I'm going to face, because I probably have an answer or a rebuttal for you that's backed by a peer-reviewed article instead of just your little Instagram screenshot, you know?
That's fantastic.
Well, it's hard with social media, because we were talking about that earlier, but like people can post anything and then it can get shared as many times as people want to share it.
No one fact checks anymore either.
And people will make these claims, or they'll be like, well, disability's already been studied. I'm like, well, that's funny, because where's your peer-reviewed article? Because my 4 peer-reviewed articles said that there's X, Y, and Z still missing. And
I always find that the pushback is a sign of success, because if there is a pushback against you changing a system that is so ingrained in people's way of thinking that it's not even conscious, that means there's a saying in Spanish, it doesn't exist in English, it goes, si te pica, te aplica, and it's like, if it itches, it's because you identify with it. Like, it stings, you know? If the person you're speaking to is stung by what you're saying, and all you're saying is the way your research may or may not be slightly predatory towards vulnerable communities because of this and this and this, like, why is your face hot? Unpack that.
I will say the opposite, too. I was in a meeting yesterday where somebody was saying this thing passed unanimously, and a faculty member said, well, then it probably doesn't say anything. If you get unanimous support for something, it's probably pretty watered down.
Instead of being detail-oriented, it's more broad picture, which, of course, we need a lot of broad picture perspectives and initiatives. But if an idea is broken down into several segments, subtopics, differing perspectives, and there's no one disagreeing with it, it means that it's too generalized. It's way too generalized. Like, there should be people that feel strongly about it. If there are no people feeling strongly about it, what is missing? What makes people feel strongly about it?
What's making them itch?
So that kind of ties in why personal experiences matter so much to the climate supporter, to the every single person that exists in the world. If you don't have something that's driving you, if you don't have something making you itch, then you're not going to give the same energy that people, you know, that are itching are going to give. And then you
won't.
Such
a good analogy.
It really is a great analogy. I just find that you need to be passionate about it on a personal level. And so many issues are being spoken about in such a overgeneralized way that no one can identify with them, that people just feel every experience is distant to them. And it
does
not.
You know, that's interesting that you're saying that, because I have been saying recently, too, in line with your thinking, that ESF needs to recognize its role as an educator and bring the information to people. People who have fear and a desire to be helpful in this space around climate change, and they don't know what they can do. Because everything is so big And it's like, well, what can I do in my space and what can I model for people? And my experience is people want to be helpful, generally speaking, but what can they do in their own homes that makes us more sustainable and more environmentally friendly? I want to ask you just both a couple questions before we finish. One is, what's next? So you, Isabella, you're going to have this information for institutions about really best practices for engaging in research in communities like the one you grew up in. What are you going to do with that? Who's your audience and how is that going to be dispersed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm engaging mostly with academics that represent university institutions or colleges because I want to speak to the people that feel defensive about this. I'm being very, very careful with my phrasing, which is very unlike me. But my phrasing throughout the whole thesis is delicate. It's a very introductory way to present these people to these big, scary topics. So I would say that unlike most of my organizing that panders to the vulnerable, marginalized communities and their experiences, I'm trying to actually make these academics resonate with the experiences that they have not felt. Like you were saying earlier, Joni, a lot of people can't even fathom living in a reality where climate change is already affected, where all of these realities are intersecting. So what I am seeking to do is make these people that have no reason to feel identified with these communities empathize for them in a way that applies to how they research, how they engage with them, and their potential for long-term commitment and resources provider.
That's excellent. And how about you, Savannah? What is this culmination of your work?
My project's actually right now called the Three Scales Project because it's aiming for a human, institutional, and global implementation of new protocol. And naturally, the global implementation will come with the mass replication in human and institutional scales. So my final product of my capstone will essentially be this book for institutions and also for humans. So when we talk about the human scale and harmful protocol, I'm going to give you a really easy example. The norm to shake somebody's hand upon meeting them, or you see someone and you greet them with a hug. In what world did anyone ever tell anyone that they could touch me, you know? But there are these protocols for someone who has OCD, PTSD, autism, right? Like these are negative sensory experiences, or they might be flashbacks or traumatic experiences. And so there are harmful protocol that humans do day to day to each other, one, two, three people, not even on the institutional scale. So there will be a human component of this of, you know, I'm a human. And as an individual, what can I do in my daily life to view a disability in a new light or to help a disabled person or to help with the advocacy component? And how are my behaviors possibly harmful to that community? And then we'll look at the institutional scale, which is a little bit more complex, but these will be able to go to administration of hospitals, healthcare, education. And when I deliver these to the institutions and also say, you know, this is the human component and it's going to go with it. And if you can deliver these to your employees, that's for everybody. The human component is for everybody. The institutional component is for people who are creating protocol that lots of people have to follow. So that will be the primary outcome, is just two separate documents, one that focuses on human behavior and then the other one that focuses on like institutional and more of like the policy side of things.
Once again, it's very similar to what I'm doing, but I combined them both into one big document because I found that engaging with people personally may cause this interest, whereas engaging with people on an institutional level and kind of like letting it trickle down might be more effective. But I'm interested to see how both of our ideas develop.
Yeah, and I think for the human side of things, it doesn't necessarily have to be like this, you're a terrible person, you're doing this wrong, fix it. You know, it's here's the suggestion. Yeah. Let me plant the seed for you, because there's a chance that maybe you just aren't fully educated about the topic,
or
maybe
you're doing things. Which was Isabel's point. Like, we shouldn't be shaming people who don't know,
that you're not aware of. And like my example with the handshaking, you know, I have so many people in my life who are like, I don't like hugs, I don't like shaking hands. I'm one of those people. I don't want hugs. I don't, unless I know you and I'm comfortable with it. Typically I'll say, oh, I'm not a hugger. Right. But these protocol, they've been ingrained into people's brains for how many years, or it's just become like a natural social practice. And sometimes those practices aren't wanted or desired. So there's just ways to be more cognizant as a human being about how you're engaging with these people. And slowly but surely, these human behaviors and the way they were able to change this perception of disability just creates more room at the table for people. It creates a positive outlook on other people. It makes you be more empathetic and more accepting. And when I think about talking about pushback and people that are very firm in their beliefs, and I feel like because so many topics are so ego driven and or they trigger people's egos, there's a lack of introspection. And anyone I've ever met in my life who has the ability to be introspective has no problem welcoming a new idea or being given a document or even somebody saying, hey, you did this thing and it really upset me or it hurt me. Anyone I know who is able to emotionally process and be introspective is like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Like, I didn't realize. Let me act on that differently
but
next
of
time.
Of course, I feel like it's really important to know that this is a learnable skill, even if you're not the type of person that is able to or that really struggles to engage with people that have different life experiences to you. If you find it difficult to open your brain to other perspectives and you're aware of it, it is not. It is a learnable skill. And
absolutely,
I think it's both. What both of us are trying to do here is teach a very learnable skill that people don't even find to be learnable. They're so ingrained in them.
You know, it's very interesting. And I love the way you said it and running in my head through a whole bunch of examples. But introspective people are able to hear the changes both of you want to make and listen and agree that they want to do better next time and learn from what you're talking about. And I think if people could hear that, I think everybody wants to be known as introspective.
Yeah.
But really, it is a pretty clear line of demarcation, right? Is if you're immediately defensive and right and not listening and not thinking that there is possibly a better way or that not everybody feels the same way you do.
And everybody wants to say that they're an honest person or, oh, I'm accountable, I'm honest. Well, honesty and accountability is also recognizing the views of other people or allowing them the space to step in there with their factual evidence.
I love that you keep coming back to science and facts and data. That's like, you know, the world would be a better place if more people were.
Yeah, the numbers don't lie.
That's education kicking in. If you're not citing your sources, what are you doing?
Yeah, or people will make these large blanket claims about things that are so complex.
It's a fallacy.
Yeah.
I saw it on Instagram.
Part of what I'm dealing with is like my topic, even just healthcare alone. You can't talk about healthcare and try to dismantle it until you address big pharma and the model of disability and the patient protocol and the intersectionality. Like, there are so many things that go into one thing. And so for you to deny that these issues occur in every single place or that these are simple issues that can have a yes or no perspective, that's dishonest and lacking accountability.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really disappointing to me is people saying it's black or it's white. There's no nuance.
Sometimes it's yellow. Sometimes it's blue.
Yes.
On certain days, it's green.
I totally agree. So you're bringing me to my final question. And I will say before that, I love this conversation. I really love ESF students generally. And specifically, I've gotten to know both of you and I am big fans of both of you. And I'm so excited to watch where you go in your lives. But what would each of you tell a student who's considering where they want to go to college? What would you tell them about ESF?
I'm going to have to start this one. When I came to ESF, I was not knowledgeable about anything relating to American institutions. I came to ESF because I knew I wanted to do environmental law. And ESF was just the best program that showed up in Google. I didn't even get to visit the campus. I showed up here blind in the middle of COVID.
How brave.
Yeah, brave is one word for it. Some people say insane. And when I got here, I was scared. I was terrified. ESF is a very different place. So a lot of what stereotypes for normal academic institutions sounds like. But if I had to tell a student that is passionate about the environment where to go, I wouldn't hesitate to tell them to come here. I know ESF gave me the resources and education I need to continue my field in the environmental sector. And not even just stopping there, the connections, the mentors. ESF is such a small, dedicated community that I'd have to recommend it to any student that's passionate about environmental issues.
Yeah, I like what you said about it being like a small, dedicated community. It's interesting because I lived on campus, and so I was here all the time. And being on campus, you're sort of like protected from the outside world.
Yes,
you know, I feel like a little bubble of protection when I'm at ESF, and then I leave, and I'm like, oh my goodness, downtown is crazy. Where am I? I want to go home. You know, but I think that level of like protection, knowing that people have your back, there are so many resources, and the intersection of so many points revolving around climate change. If you're in landscape architecture and you're passionate about climate change, if you are environmental science or environmental studies, like there are so many different routes to get connected to other people in different disciplines. And I, as a landscape architect, I've talked to people in biology. I've talked to people in chemistry. I've talked
Shout
to so
biotech,
many people.
Yeah.
Like there are so many great resources, and we all understand here that climate change is not just one pin on a map. Like there are so many things that go into it. And so the studies that you can do surrounding it are endless.
And you're surrounded with people like-minded, which mm-hmm. I think is a very interesting way to go to college.
It's an echo chamber, yes, but it is a factually correct and verifiable echo chamber.
Oh, yeah.
So
very
a
good.
Legit echo chamber. I do think it's interesting, though, because it is still a state school, right? So there are still like policies and things that we have to follow as students here that are like some of the more passionate, outspoken people and the students here, at least, including some of the faculty, are sort of early action adopters, right? So we'll go into these things with our full hearts and chomp away at the bit and get things done. Whereas I feel like other institutions are either like fact-based or experience-based
reactive
adopters.
Reactive rather than proactive.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even just like hesitant adopters. Like they don't want anything to do with the progressive thoughts or studies or protocol and things like that. And I feel like here we tend to have a student body and a faculty body that is a little bit leaning more towards the early action and science-based adopters.
Yeah. So if you want to be on the cutting edge,
yep.
you want to be at ESF.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I absolutely love that. That is a very good note to end on. And thank you. I know you're both busy with school, and taking time to sit and talk to me has very generous of you.
No, this was so fun.
Thank you so much for your time.
Isabel, thank you very much. See you around.
Thank you.
Thank you.